Our present lecture will be on the angels, continuing our catechism on the angels. Remember where we are. It is especially in angelology, which is the science of the angels. It is especially here that we must distinguish levels of the Church's teaching. Remember we said the highest level was the formally defined dogma. Where dogma means doctrine which has been explicitly revealed and is taught as such by the Church. I cannot tell you how important it is to make these distinctions, because speaking of development of doctrine, I would say the two areas with the widest development of doctrine are Mariology and Angelology. Remarkable growth in doctrine. Remember what we said before. Development of doctrine does not mean any objective change in content. Development of doctrine means the Church's deeper and clearer grasp, century after century, of what has been revealed, but under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, she, the Church, comes to see the meaning, the depth, the clarity, and the certitude of what God had already revealed. We're now looking at what we're calling the fourth level of the Church's teaching. This fourth level is commonly called certain doctrine. Notice there is a shift from doctrine which is infallible to doctrine which is merely certain. Infallibility implies irreversibility. I assure you, these are not just words. An irreversible doctrine, therefore, cannot objectively be changed. Certainly implies that something is not to be doubted without claiming that it is infallible. An example of angelic certainty would be that every human being, from the moment of conception, has a guardian angel. That is certain doctrine. We do not, however, say it is infallible teaching. In other words, the Church has forborne, to use that term, from making that kind of irreversible teaching. Nevertheless, that each of us, from the moment of conception, had and have a guardian spirit, a certain teaching in the Catholic Church. Another example would be that on creation, all the angels received sufficient grace to attain their heavenly destiny. This is critically important. Notice, both angels and human beings belong to the same class in that both the angels and we have sufficient grace to reach our heavenly destiny. That does not mean that some angels don't receive more grace, pardon me, did not receive more grace than others. Whether angels or human beings, grace as grace is received only until the beginning of eternity. In other words, we receive grace until our bodies die. Once we enter eternity, no more grace. The term we then use is glory. So, same with the angels. The angels not having a body cannot speak of an angel dying. For the angels did, however, without going through a mortal stage, they did, however, have a period of probation. Our probation is combined with our mortality. The angels, although immortal from the first moment of their existence, they were immortal, but they had to be tried. Question now 49 on the angels. What is the fifth level of the church's teaching on the angels? You might say, Father, why go through these levels? Well, I'm doing this because I realize the importance of knowing that angelology has a wide range of truths, but they are not all on the same level of authority on the side of the church. On this level, the church teaches what we call probable doctrine about the angelic world. Here it is assumed that the teaching may be legitimately accepted by the mind and put into devotional practice without claiming that the doctrine is so certain it would be sinful to call it into question. In other words, there are things we may hold regarding the angels without sinning if we doubt. A common example of probable doctrine is that all the angels, both the saved and the lost, originally created in the state of sanctifying grace, those who remained in sanctifying grace reached heavenly glory. Those who were unfaithful to the will of God lost sanctifying grace. And of course, the beatific vision. It is also probable doctrine that God appoints only one guardian angel for each human being. May we hold that either we or other people have more than one guardian angel? Yes, we may. You see the logic behind what I'm sharing with you. The angel then remains the protective spirit of that person until bodily death, but is not reassigned to anyone else until the end of the world. I repeat, a probable doctrine. Number 50. And finally, gosh, it's about time we finished. The sixth and final doctrinal level. This is the level of permissibility. The heaven positions on the state and function of the angels being all speculative for the mind to believe and permissible for the will to put into practice. I should add that over the centuries, it is positively mind-boggling on the variety of ideas, positions, theories, speculation about the angels. This level of angelic theology is literally an ocean. It covers innumerable ideas that pious believers have held about the angelic world and put these ideas into practical devotion. To be stressed, however, is that they are permissible, which means you can hold them and in no way infringe on your Catholic faith. One of a thousand examples is that only individuals have their own guardian angels. And not only individuals, but also societies. For example, Assumption Grotto has one or more guardian angels. Can you hold that? Yes. Cities. Oh, how many guardian angels Detroit needs. And states. Whole nations. In our day, depending on how the election turns out, this is all permissible teaching. Am I still clear? God then would provide or will provide with angelic assistance, including whole nations. Now, theological evidence. I should explain, since I've been to Haiti, my body has not been behaving the way it did before. Keep in your prayers. We are still talking about, of course, angelology. But here, the theological evidence. In other words, how has theology deduced, reached conclusions from the Church's teaching? Here is the sequence that will be followed in the Catechism. What is the Church's official teaching? They will quote documents of the Church over the centuries. Following the ecclesiastical sources, the sacred scriptures, what does the Bible say about the angels? And here especially, I warn you, be careful when you read books by Protestants, no matter how religious or pious they may be, about the angels. Because without the guidance of the Church, the Bible, as you know, can be a very enigmatic, to put it mildly, source of knowledge. The angels in the Bible are so numerous and so constant, we might almost speak of the Bible as God's revelation about the angels. But if there's anywhere that we need guidance in interpreting the Bible, it is surely in angelology. Then thirdly, what is sometimes called
theological reason. Reflecting on both what is revealed and what the church teaches, then human mind analyzes and draws conclusions. You might say that both revelation and the church's teaching are the premises. For example, every human being is mortal. Father Hardin is a human being. Conclusion. Therefore, Father Hardin is mortal. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm taking medication, so thanks. So there are conclusions which are reached. And I assure you, given the prevalence of materialism in the modern world, angelology will be developed beyond anything you've ever known in centuries past. Just a powerful reaction of the human mind. Instinctively. Don't tell me that all that is real is what you can touch, taste, feel, see, or hear. And this is where over the years, in both studying Marxism, teaching on Marxism, Marxism has deeply penetrated the Western world. And as you know, in Marxism, there is no other reality except material. So we start. There exist angels. First, I note two things should be kept in mind. There can be no doubt that the angels really exist, or that they are in heavenly glory, and demons in eternal separation from God. Let me tell you, you better be sure you read that carefully, especially regarding the demons. All kinds of ideas. Moreover, the angels have an important part in our lives. Their immediate, you might say, principal responsibility is to worship God. But they, having passed their probation, they help us to, well, live out our probation. And just as the good angels are sent by God to bring us to join them in heaven, so the evil spirits are allowed by God to tempt us, which really means to try us. And if Christ himself, as we all know, was tempted by the devil, who do we think we are to be preserved from demonic temptation? All to be kept in mind is that is one thing to believe when God is revealed, and something much more to understand. And that is why I'll go turn around, answer the questions I understand are our Q&A now. We have some questions already. Please, in front of the machine. Not yet. I just want to make sure that questions are being submitted. You would think by now we should say something about the purpose of this course in angelology. Middle of page 35. The purpose of this course is not only to teach us what we are to believe about the angelic world. Our purpose is also, and I keep repeating, to be able to share our angelic faith with others. And with the number of books, countless, constantly coming out on the angels, as we've said, articles, television programs, movies, with millions being affected by the ideas that are being promoted. We better understand our own faith's teaching on the angels. In other words, it is exciting to know that a materialistic world like our own is waking up to the fact that there's more to reality than just cold, well, space or size or weight. As I tell people, you assist at a person's deathbed, conscious, speaking with you, praying with you, and they close their eyes. In other words, you have to be out of your mind to question how there is an invisible, sensibly imperceptible reality which, well, leaves the living person, no, a dead corpse. In other words, that the most real reality in the world is not material, is not measurable. It is spiritual. So, page 36. Notice first we say, as far as the church authority on the angels goes, there are three principal sources of our authority on the angels. They are the Fourth Lateran Council, the First Vatican, and the Second Vatican Council. It is impossible to exaggerate the importance of the Fourth Lateran Council and anticipating the quiz that I hope to give you. Remember the date. It's 12:15. What was the occasion? The occasion was to defend the faith against the Albigenses. Remember, back in the 4th and 5th centuries, there was a heresy called Manichaeism. And a genius like St. Augustine, for 9 years, was a Manichaean. according to Manichaeism, from which Albigensianism derived, there are two ultimate sources of reality. Okay, page 37. There was a good deity who created the world of the spirit, and an evil god who created the material world, including the human body, which is under his control. I cannot tell you how many, especially among so-called Catholic dissidents, on the church's moral doctrine go back to Manichaeism today, 1996, and accuse the Catholic Church of being either Manichaean, Manichaeistic, or Albigensian. That the body is evil, and therefore that bodily pleasure, Catholic Church considers to be wrong. Is that true? Absolutely false. According to the Albigenses, the good deity sent Jesus Christ as a creature to deliver human souls from their imprisonment. On these terms, the good angels were created by the good deity and the devils by the evil god. Over the years, in teaching theology, I've never tired telling people that in the 16th century, when Protestantism came into the Western world, two devastating errors condemned centuries before by the Catholic Church came together. Manichaeism and Pelagianism. In Pelagianism, there's no need for grace. All you need is a good, strong will. Who gets to heaven? Those who use their willpower. That is absolutely false. All the willpower in the world will get nobody to heaven. You need God's grace. Of course you've got to use your willpower to cooperate with the grace. You've got to have something to cooperate with, namely divine grace. And Manichaeism, which, and you might say almost the opposite of Pelagianism, if in Pelagianism the key is the will and no grace, in Manichaeism it's all grace and no free will, now Luther and Calvin were not as crude as was Manichaeus, but without saying necessarily that those who will go to heaven were created by the good God and those who go to hell were created by the devil, which is what Manichaeus held. Bedrock Protestantism has not changed in 450 years. There is no free will in man's nature. If you get the grace, you'll get to heaven. If you don't get the grace, sorry, you'll be lost. And this is where Manichaeism has so deeply pervaded Western thought. that our prisons are filled to overflowing. As one prisoner whom I visited in Virginia told me, this jail was made for some 800 prisoners. We now have over 2,000. We're overcrowded. In other words, there is such a thing as a free will for which people are responsible. It's not just, as every book in psychology tells us, it is not just heredity, education, and environment. A Manichaean triad in the modern world. Am I clear? No, we've got a free will. What then was the teaching of the Fourth Lateran Council? I divided the teaching into several parts. And each one of these deserves a lecture, several lectures, all by itself. First, there's only one true God, eternal, immense, unchangeable, incomprehensible, omnipotent, and undescribable. By the way, these divine attributes, it is well to memorize. They're part of our faith. Only one God. And of course, this one God is, needless to say, a good God. Over the years in teaching comparative religion for my students, there has never been a polytheistic religion in human history. Never. And widespread throughout the world today, all polytheistic religions, all of them have both good and bad deities. Am I clear? And behind the logic, of course, is, well, dispensing oneself of one's own responsibility. As Augustine told, being a Manichaean, for his conversion, told the good God, "Oh, my dear good God, anytime you want to take over and conquer the evil deity who has control of me, by all means, I'll be very happy. In the meantime, sorry, I'll enjoy myself." And what converted Augustine, this is, oh, how crucial this is, the greatest mind in my judgment after St. Paul, what converted St. Augustine was discovery, oh no, I've got a free will. And that can be a great revelation to some people. Secondly, God has no beginning. He always is and always will be. A good definition of creatures. Creatures are beings that began. And now, there are so many, and in theological circles, some call them great minds. You know, great minds can go wrong. When they go wrong, they really go bad. That God has no beginning. Always was, always will be. And is absolutely, utterly unchangeable. Karl Rahner was never convinced there was such a God. Thomas Merton was never convinced there was such a God. And these two minds have affected millions in our world today. Thirdly, God is the creator of all things, visible and invisible, spiritual and corporeal, who by his almighty power, from the very beginning of time, has created both orders of creation in the same way out of nothing, the spiritual or angelic world and the corporeal or visible universe. These are really quotations. They are solemn definitions. Notice what we're saying. Only God existed from all eternity. Everything and everyone else began. And the moment God created, time began. Time, as I'm sure we've said before, is the measure of motion, the measure of change. There must be changeable things in existence before you can have time. Until God created, there was no time, because there were not changeable beings. And are we ever changeable beings? But notice, both material and the spiritual, God created them both. I cannot begin to tell you how widespread are the errors which question, even positively deny, the real distinction between the spiritual and the material. And just for the record, I think we've said this before. The material is that which can be perceived by the senses. The spiritual is that which can be perceived only by the mind. And I'm not sure whether I've spoken to you people about this, but our English vocabulary is studded with materialism. We use the word nonsense. Every child knows what nonsense is. That which cannot be perceived by the senses. Say that again. Nonsense is that which cannot be perceived by the senses. Are you saying that if something cannot be perceived by the senses, it is nonsense? Without a second thought, we're describing something. Oh, that does not matter. Matter. Or, it's immaterial to me. It's meaningless to me. Our vocabulary is just penetrated with ideas that either completely exclude or at least call into question the reality of a non-material world, which is real and about which you cannot say it does not matter. Fourth definition, afterwards. That, by the way, is part of the teaching of Fourth Lateran. God formed the creature man when he belongs to both orders, as he is composed of spirit and body. We're not merely bodily, we're not merely spiritual. Unlike us, the angels do not have a body. But you don't you dare say Now the angels are nobody. Am I still clear? Our language just penetrated. Everywhere you turn, it's a matter of this and material that. The devil, and this is one of the main reasons for this, for the Lateran Council. The devil and other demons were created by God. Good, according to their nature. But they made themselves evil by their own doing. Oh, that should be etched in bronze and burnt into our minds. We were created by God. But we can make ourselves evil by our own doing. And behind that statement is, of course, a profound mystery. In other words, as I've said over the years, the two greatest mysteries of our faith are Holy Trinity in God and liberty in man. Human liberty is a mystery. But we better believe it. You've got a free will. We can choose. What an incredible statement. We can choose what is contrary to the will of God. The Almighty, except for whom we would be nothing, gave us the power to say either yes or no to our Creator. Let me tell you, once it really, really dawns on you, once it penetrates your mind that I am a creature, I owe everything, everything to God. And then I'll use this will to give everything back to God. I'll never hold back. And suppose I start asking some questions. I may have to use my... Thank you. Can we pray to the guardian angel for person on their behalf? Oh, yes. Pray to your guardian angel, pray to that person's guardian angel. I've done this often. Well, I do it regularly. Is it necessary? Mandatory for the local bishop to be informed or approve of an apostolate for it to be to function in the diocese. Well, if it's an apostolate with a group which enters the lives of other people, permission should be received from the ordinary of the diocese. Please mention about Fabian Bruskowitz, STD, and his stand regarding dissidents. I'm sure you've heard the good news about my good friend, Bishop Bruskowitz. It is very promising. And you know what he did. He excommunicated people belonging to various associations. including, oh no, oh no, the call to action started in 1966 in the wonderful city of Detroit. Well, of course, he's getting all the flack he's getting. But pray for Bishop Ruskovitz. Pray also that other bishops will join him in his courageous and outspoken zeal. Was the Blessed Virgin Mother immortal automatically?